handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
A very good Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Monday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports on 964. Listening to Sirius XM online and at the website, too, stevebeck.com. A holiday weekend, which is always welcome. It's certainly welcome for Tina. Tina's... There's nothing that raises her spirits like a 4-day weekend, 3-day weekend, no school today. And for us that are going to play the races, we got some added opportunity today with New York running and California as well. Fairgrounds back today, given what's really been a notable weekend, and the LeCompte and the Silver Bullet Day and everything that went on at Fairgrounds on Saturday. One more card, including some holdovers, those fillies that were going to run, that might have run in the Silver Bullet Day, where Chris Block with the, you know, the minor upset, that Charlie's Penny. And in fact, I think Ed on Wednesday, when we were looking ahead to that, I think Ed liked Charlie's Penny, and she was, you know, she was an alternative to the, you know, to the obvious. And the other fillies that are coming back, the three of them, I think all three of them, right, are in there today in that allowance. What's it go? It goes as the seventh. Yeah, Princess Theorem and Minute Waltz and Divine Comedy. And see if Brad Cox with Divine Comedy can't kind of make up for a little bit of a disappointing pair of performances for his three-year-olds, male and female, on Saturday. Mandaloon in the boys' race, and I'm gonna draw a blank on the filly that the Judmont filly, Sunpath. They both disappointed. So we'll see. That's one of a few features today that are well worth looking at. The Interborough in New York, and you got the Megahertz at Santa Anita on the heels of yesterday's Grade 3 Astra. How about the Hieronis Sadler Exacta in the Astra with Quick? And yeah, then a lot of other Monday options, Parks and Laurel and more. And we'll look ahead later. Nick Tamaro, actually, in hour three, as promised, the Monday, holiday Monday. You can't have holiday Monday without a Nick visit. And we'll actually start. We'll probably get a little bit of, maybe get a glance at the Megahertz. Jay Bribman is going to join us first this morning because, of course, the release on Saturday morning of the Eclipse finalists. And you can't have a release of the Eclipse finalists without a little bit of consternation. And, I suppose I would have been prepared to be miffed when they made announcements. I didn't expect to be miffed with the announcement of the finalists. Honestly, I don't know why it's such a personal peak, I guess, or you know, area of interest for me year after year on the owner side. And I just get crazed when it seems like appropriate, you know, honorees are either overlooked or, you know, fall short. I mean, we certainly actively campaigned for several years to get Seth Klarman acknowledged, and he got over the top last year on the certainly on the strength in no small part of Mortar, but he would have been a worthy Eclipse winner for at least the two previous years, maybe even three. I'd have to go. I save all of that. And of course, last year in Seth Klarman winning the Eclipses as owner, it overshadowed Gary Barber, who had a year that in most other circumstances would have been easily good enough to be selected to be honored. So now comes 2020, and Gary Barber has every bit of good, as good a year, both as a individual owner and in partnership with a couple of different makeups. And winning 12 graded stakes, either alone or in partnership, six grade ones, one grade two, and five grade threes, with seven different horses, two of which are going to be champions, it appears, VQuist and Chattelmaker. And then also Got Stormy, War of Will, Get Her Number, Laura's Light, and 260. So 12 graded stake wins, six grade ones, one grade two, five grade threes. Eight of those, 215, came as a standalone owner. And Gary Barber wasn't even included as a finalist when he should easily have pulled this balloting as the top owner. And you know, and when I went back to look at the at how this thing played out, it's glaring that just looking at the earnings was the method by which voting was conducted. Godolphin Team Authentic, which is kind of bizarre to me that you know, this agglomeration that owned Authentic is somehow singled out as top owner because they came together to own the horse of the year, the likely horse of the year, and three-year-old champion. If you're giving him the horse of the year and the three-year-old champion, I'm sorry, it doesn't have to be vote. The ownership team with the one horse doesn't need to be voted as the leading owner. I mean, leading owner means collectively. Okay, Godolphin had a nice year. They had half a dozen graded stake winners. Fine. Seth Klarman again, you know, had a very good year, does not have championship contenders this year. But for Gary Barber to somehow not, and I've explained this, the vote, and Jay will get into it. I should just actually stop and just let Jay handle this because I get just incensed at this. You've got to look beyond the earnings. The earnings, it doesn't, you got to look at the stakes, look at the kinds of horses. This one makes me a little nuts. I acknowledge Godolphin actually on the breeding side. I included them in the voting as a breeder, and they were one of the other. I went Barber, Klarovich, Three Diamonds. Three Diamonds had, the Wyckoffs had a fabulous year, and as I've explained before, the third slot, a lot of times I'll try to acknowledge, you know, somebody that's not going to get first place votes, but had a very notable year. Starship Jubilee. See, there's a, and she didn't make the finals. you know, this gets into the whole Breeders' Cup, you know, the long shadow of the Breeders' Cup over the voting. And in certain places, yes, I get it. The Whitmore discussion, you know, that we've actually had a little bit even in advance of the finalists being announced. But this one with the owner, and every year, this is my windmill to tilt, I guess. So we'll let Jay, Jay, in writing up the finalists, he doesn't editorialize, but he points out, you know, some of the anomalies, let's say, and some of them are, you know, not hair splitting, but they're nuanced. There are nuanced discussions in here, including, the trainer scenario where it was expected that Brad Cox and Bob Baffert would be two of them. And then the third, I voted for Chad Brown. Steve Asmussen ended up as the third finalist. And, I even thought about Mike Maker actually as a third. Those were the five to me: Cox, Baffert, Brown, Asmussen, Maker. Those were the five that, I considered in some, degree or another. But other than that, there's little areas that can be discussed. And of course, one of them also was on the Horse of the Year, which is a little unusual that there's Horse of the Year debate about the trio: Authentic, Monomoy Girl, Improbable, and the ewe and cry went out that somehow Swiss Skydiver was slighted by not being a Horse of the Year finalist. I don't buy that, but she's going to be the champion 3-year-old filly. That's another part. A lot of this is the approach. I've said this many times. There's no rules to this. So, voters have their own criteria or the view of the industry and the view of the value. For me, acknowledging as many appropriate parties as possible enters into it. Kind of a spread the wealth scenario. That's why I don't think that Team Authentic needed to be voted for as owner. It's just idiotic. The owner. Anyway, start again. there was actually a lot to do with Jay, typically reach for Jay on Fridays and we preview into the weekend, but I'm actually glad that we didn't do it, because in addition to the Eclipse conversation to have with Jay, there were two passings that Jay is especially qualified to address. Bruce Headley, a literal frontiersman. I how else could you say it? He literally, when I had a conversation with him, he and Asa, his wife, it was a Breeders' Cup that it's probably it was one of maybe one of the years that there were the back to back Breeders' Cups, 08-09. And I sat with them on one of those benches, off of the paddock path to the track by the bookstore, and had the most delightful afternoon. I probably sat with them 2.5 hours, pausing to watch races, but and just got regaled with stories. A unique, different kind of individual, and a standalone, one of a kind horseman. And he literally learned, he learned from the, you know, the 20th century's great West Coast horseman. And he told me about, and I thought that this might make a make a spot in his obits. I directed people to the Dan Ross article at Thoroughbred Commentary. Dan Ross, about 5 years ago maybe, wrote a wonderful profile of Bruce Headley. And Headley told me about, you know, some of his early, I asked him, I think, you know, who influenced you or who taught you. And he talked about learning some horsemanship from a cowboy that came to California in a covered wagon, literally, in the 1800s. And, you know, he had things that he did. And Jay will speak to this. He didn't believe in schooling horses in the paddock, that it would hype them up and make them nervous. And that was something that always stuck with me. That, you know, once you started bringing them to the paddock, and once they started, you know, associating the paddock with, you know, with a race, they would get, you know, enervated and all hyped up. And then when you would bring them back, they might not eat and, you know, put them off, you know, potentially put them off their feet. It was some really interesting things that his approach. And, you know, then of course had a homestead, literally a homestead, that has a homestead in Arcadia, where he could take horses for turnouts, like Kona Gold would turn out in the backyard behind the house, where he could literally keep an eye on them. And that, you know, that's something I regret. He invited me to the house to see his art collection, one of the foremost collectors of equine art. I won't limit it to racing, because he was a big collector of Remingtons, of the bronze casts. Fascinating guy. And there was a huge outpouring directed at Bruce Headley. And we'll let Jay talk about him. Jay got to, you know, cover him for years. And the other passing that another individual to pay tribute to, Nat Wess, who as a executive and as a publicist, you know, had decades long career, and another individual just, you know, really beloved and respected and appreciated, and cut across, really one of these classic racetrack executives more than a racetrack executive. He came from an era where there was a certain interchangeability, where the track publicist could work in the racing office or in a management capacity. I talked about the Oscar Otis book, the biography that Dr. Alvarado published, and my life in racing. And Otis had that, you know, worked for newspapers, but at the same time would come in and work some meets as a track publicist. There was a certain interchangeability, and Nat Wess, on the, you know, the back end of his career, associated with the, you know, the start of Canterbury. And was driving force behind the Claiming Crown, and started countless careers in, you know, the communications departments. And we'll let Jay tell you more about Nat. In fact, I've got to reach. There's some other people that even reached out. You know, wanted to make sure that appropriate homage to Nat Wess would be pain, and it will be without a doubt. There was another. There's actually two others even that I've got to mention. Ray Amato Jr., who I told you late last fall was ailing and a victim of pancreatic cancer, and you know, for those there's certainly you know, anybody that that is in a barn and has you know anything about the community of the farrier of the you know the guys that are taking care of feet, Ray Amato and his father are legendary, and Ray had his hand and of course works specifically for Todd Pletcher and has for years and years. Ray was taken by pancreatic cancer, and you know there's so many friends from in Kentucky, New York, Florida that really were sad, and they knew it was coming. This was not, and Ray was stoic about it himself. Very very tough, very tough. 50. Mid-50s, not even mid-50s. And then one other that I've reached out to another race tracker, Alan Plever. I've asked Alan to join us today or tomorrow to pay tribute to Wayne Dearden, another you know, kind of cowboy horseman, a self-taught horseman from Michigan and actually from the South, but long associated with Michigan, who won, they say, 1,300 races on Equibase. It might as well be 13,000. There's no way to know how many races that Wayne Dearden won, because for many years he sent out horses for other people because he couldn't take the trainer's test. And so he trained horses, but they ran in other people's names in the 60s and 50s, whatever. And then eventually he was given an oral trainer's test, which he easily passed. A huge family, and I'm hoping that Alan will be able to join us to pay tribute to Wayne Dearden as well. So a very, it's been brutal already this year. We've lost too many people who were respected and loved and who you know, helped others around the game. Jay Pribman joins us right off the break this morning for, you know, literally a roundup of things, including the LeCompte one. I haven't even really talked about that yet. Jay, good morning.
Steve, how are you?
I'm good. It's this was kind of a mixed bag a weekend, given some passings and two that were very you were well associated between Bruce Headley and Nat West. Let's start there, and then we'll move to cheerier topics.
Yeah, that was a kind of a double gut punch. You know, Nat, top racetrack publicist and then executive, well-known in California and in Minnesota. He did a lot of work at Canterbury, and some of the things that he was associated with were the first Breeders' Cup. He was the publicist at Hollywood Park for that. He went to work for the CTBA and helped launch the Cal Cup. He helped launch Canterbury Park when it opened back in the mid-80s. And he ended up actually, he and his wife, when he retired, he ended up settling in the suburbs of Minneapolis. But he used to come to California for a good chunk of the winter until a few years ago. They'd take a place in near Santa Anita for about 3 months, and it was great. He'd come to the track, he'd socialize with him, and you know, I knew him for you know literally 40 years, because when I first started covering the races, I was still in college. I was working part-time for a paper in L.A., And the first race I covered at Hollywood Park was a race in the 1980s, and you know, it was a couple years before I started working full time. And you know, even though I was some, you know, greenhorn kid we'd never met before, obviously, and still in college, and he treated me great, just like I was, you know, as important as the guys who've been covering the races at the Herald Examiner, the LA Times, for years. And but not only that, I mean, he loved the game. I mean, he was just really—he was always an upbeat guy. You know, loved the sport, and it was just—you know—can't say enough good things about him. So it was just really unfortunate to find out that he had passed over the weekend. And then, like you said, Bruce Headley as well. Obviously, one of the premier horsemen in California over the years in terms of what he accomplished with what he had, and the way he would manage his horses. As soon as there was any inkling that something might be cropping up, they got time, and that's why horses like Kona Gold and Soft Shoe Sure Shot and Son of a Pistol and all the, you know, so many others that he's known for being associated with. Going back to, you know, Variety Road and Sylvieville and Variety Baby and horses like that. I mean, they had long careers owing to his horsemanship. But I loved, and I'm sure I know you did too, Steve, hearing the old stories that he would tell from his days of his youth when he was, you know, he grew up learning to ride at a place called Susie Q Ranch, which was a ranch east of, south and east of Santa Anita. And it's where Bill Shoemaker started out too. So, and he knew Shoe from back in those days. Shoe was a couple of years older than him, but not much. So obviously a pretty significant loss on that side of the track too. And then, like I say, from the publicist and executive suite, you know, Nat West.
You know, Headley, there's so many elements actually that you could tie in here, and including keeping Kona Gold on the track as a pony, and you and I talked about you know, the house close by, you know, within the city limits of Arcadia essentially, and I mean, he had like a ranch. It has a ranch where the horses would turn out. I mean, it's just a unique part of Santa Anita and Southern California racing lore. And Jay, one thing that has surprised me about the obits is the omission about his brother, about Gus.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's got a son, Gus, and then his, you know, his daughter, Karen, and, you know, his wife, Osa, have been in the game for a long time. So, you know, he had a, you know, great background, and his family is involved in racing. So you can talk more about that if you want.
Yeah, well, I'm sure others this week, anybody from the West Coast, will undoubtedly figure in. We'll save the racing for last. Let's turn to the hard news on the Eclipse announcement, and this is always, it's always a fertile field for discussion.
Well, they announced the finalists, or I see it referred to a lot of times as nominations in some articles or posts by people. These are the top three vote getters in each division, and that's who are listed as the quote-unquote finalists. But it's not like there's a re-vote on the three finalists that are left to determine the winner. The winners are already determined. They just haven't been announced yet, and they won't be for another week and a half on Thursday, January 28th. So these were the top three vote-getters in each division. And, you know, I think by and large, the winners are pretty obvious in most divisions. You know, Authentic's going to be champion 3-year-old male, and Probable's going to be the champion older horse, with Skydiver's going to be the champion 3-year-old filly. I mean, you just look at, it's pretty obvious who the top ones were. And, you know, I think you can nitpick on who maybe should have been second or third in some of these and received a finalist berth. There were some horses that were overlooked, you know, in the older female dirt division, for instance. You know, there were only two horses in that division that won two grade ones last year. One of them is Monomoy Girl, who is going to win the division, I'm sure, and deservedly so, with the Breeders' Cup win and a 4-for-4 record. You know, the other one was Cece, and she didn't finish in the top three. And that, to me, is just odd. And it doesn't matter in the end in terms of who's going to win, but it's a nice tribute to the campaign of horses if they end up finishing in the top three. And I think there were other examples like that. You know, Bell's the One for female sprinter didn't end up in the top three, but Glass Slippers off a one-off performance in the U.S. did get a berth there. So those are ones. But like I said, in those cases, at least the winner's in there. The ones that exercise me the most are where, you know, someone who has a legitimate claim to winning a division doesn't win, let alone in a case of Gary Barber, finish in the top three. And I just find it ludicrous that, you know, Barber is not a finalist for Champion Owner, because, you know, if you actually do some research, you would know that he, and I'm not meaning saying you, Steve, I'm saying you, a voter. I'm using a, you know,
sure.
Yeah, I'm not, this isn't something that Steve Vig of anybody when it comes actually to Gary Barber from what you've been doing on the radio show, rightly so, towards the end of the year. But anyway, you know, he had 7 grade one wins, either alone or in partnership. And also, you know, I dare say that Zquist and Channelmaker have, you know, legitimate shots to win divisional titles. And nothing against Seth Klarman, because his support of racing is tremendous. But he's a finalist this year, and he had a great year. But not one of his horses is a finalist in any division this year for an Eclipse Award. And, you know, he deservedly got an Eclipse Award last year with when Bricks and Mortar was horse of the year, and he had other top horses. And he should have been a finalist a couple other previous years, but he wasn't. You know, it was his. He got overlooked for a couple of years before finally being rightly rewarded last year. But this year, to me, the voters blew it with Gary Barber. You know, when you lead in Grade One wins, when you have two potential champions, and he's not on your ballot, let alone one that you're strongly considering for first place, you blew it. There's no other way to put it in my mind.
I completely agree. Anybody that's been listening knows I've been, you know, and I'm vocal about this. There is a different approach required when it comes to the human categories. And it's funny because I went back when Saturday afternoon when this came out, I went and looked, and sure enough, It people just pulled up the earnings, I guess, and just simply shoved in Team Authentic, Godolphin, and Klarovich based on the fact that they were the top three in earnings, and gave it no other thought. And that's not enough. That it doesn't justify being involved in the vote if that's the way you're doing it.
Right, and that also, Steve, happened with breeders too. You know, the three breeder finalists were the top three in terms of earnings, trainers as well. It looks like it came out that way. I mean, you know, Chad Brown not being a finalist for trainer is nuts. I mean, he was second in grade one wins to Baffert last year, but he's not a finalist for trainer. I don't know how that happens, but the three, like your point about looking at the earnings tables, you know, the top three earners last year for Money One were Asmussen, Cox, and Baffert. Well, they ended up being the finalists, and that's fine if that's what you think matters most, but I think, you know, we've discussed this before over the years, you know, we're voting for championships here, and if you're voting for the championships of horses based on what they accomplished on the track and not who won the most money, I think you really need to do the same when you're looking at owners and breeders and you know, trainers and jockeys and apprentice jockeys. And to me, what's most incumbent is how did you do in the biggest races, the grade one races? What horses did you ride that are end up on your ballot that might be Eclipse Award winners? You know, like, for instance, if you voted for Authentic and Gamin, for instance, you know, you could then rightly have John Velasquez as for first, or even at the least a top three finalist for champion jockey. I think that's a legitimate way to look at it. And he ended up being in the top three. And there's some people might say, well, geez, he didn't have that great a year. He didn't ride that much. He sort of turned into the East Coast version of Mike Smith, riding by appointment. But you know, when you win the Kentucky Derby and the Breeders' Cup Classic and the races you won with Gamin, including the Philly and Mare Sprint, that's a heck of a resume. And I think there's a legitimate case you can make for him being on there. But there's some others here, like we were just discussing, where I think not enough research or time was taken to really examine who belongs on here. And again, to me, the compare and contrast to me is Seth Klarman and Gary Barber, both of whom are great patrons of the sport and had fantastic years. But if you look.
Yeah. That sounded like we lost Jay, Case, huh? Yeah, we'll get Jay back, and while Casey, all right, Casey will get Jay back. I'm going to ask when Jay gets back. I'm going to wonder aloud. If there's a different way to quantify, especially when it comes to this, to the ownership, and maybe it will help, people evaluating. I think Jay's back with us. Jay, I just was going to say, as a follow-up, is what you're saying. Do you think there's a better way to present the information, especially, in this era that obviously has extensive, partnership elements to it?
I mean, maybe so. Sorry about that.
That's right.
The wilds of Carlsbad here got to the phone call. Sorry we lost the connection there. I don't know, Steve. I mean, that, to me, is looking at it differently from what I would. I think the voters need to be smarter. And, if that means that there's too many people voting who don't have their head in the game, well, then maybe the voting rolls need to be looked at from all three organizations that vote, the NTRA, the National Turf Riders and Broadcasters, and the Daily Racing Form, to maybe tighten up who's voting. Because if you don't have your head in the game, then, maybe you shouldn't be doing something like this. I don't know how the stuff could be better presented. I mean, there's literally a table in the printed version of the ballot that goes out to everybody that has a listing of every owner and trainer and jockey that's associated with a grade one winner. So, I mean, you could at the least look that up. There's plenty of data online that you can look up if you want to do a deep dive on, I see how many Gary Barber has on his own. How did he do? How did some of his partnerships do? I mean, this stuff you can look up. It's actually in the printed version here. I mean, there's a Gary Barber listing for the VQuist partnership, and there's a Gary Barber listing that turns out is the group that's with Channel Maker, and then there's the Gary Barber on his own. It'd be nice if they were all, if there was like a Gary Barber and it was tabbed out and there were the other ones listed right under it, but, they're all on here. You just need to take more than 30 seconds to make a decision and maybe do some homework before voting, So I to me, it's more a problem of voters who maybe don't have their head in the game. And if that sounds elitist, I don't care. You know, this is too important to blow off and not take your time and do right.
A parallel on the horse side, and this is a more difficult, not more difficult, but just a different degree of difficulty when it comes to the, as you referenced, the one-off performances. And, you know, if a Goldakova is coming over and an Enable and Miesque, okay, I get it. But I'm sorry, Order of Australia and Glass Slippers when you could have voted for Bells the One? I it's a mystery to me. I don't buy these obscurities that come over and win. I mean, Glass Slipper's a nice horse. It doesn't deserve to be a North American Eclipse Award finalist.
No, I agree. I mean, I think Bell's the One's record in that division, you know, she's more deserving of being there. I mean, fortunately, like I was saying earlier, in the case of Glass Slippers or in the case of the absurd case of Order of Australia, you know, it's not going to determine who the champion was. I mean, the champion is not going to be either of those. There's better obvious
right.
candidates in those divisions. But it's, you know, if you own or train or bred Bell's the One, you know, or in the you know, in the mile or in the, you know, in the grass division, another possible candidate there, it's, you know, it's nice to get acknowledged as being a finalist, even if you yep. don't win. And so that those are important votes to make as well. You know, in the case of the male grass division, you know, in fairness, and you know, I think Order of Australia is an absurd vote, but you know, in fairness to those who might have opted for him, that was a terrible division. There were no really outstanding choices in that division, and you're just sort of voting for the least odious, you know, winner, because nobody stood out in there. There wasn't like a bricks and mortar situation where a horse obviously ran the table and deserved it. You had horses that just took turns beating one another, or, you know, in the case of Channelmaker, got very good at the end of the year and won two Grade Ones, or in the case of Zulu Alpha, you know, started off the year very well, but unfortunately couldn't finish out a campaign. So there was nothing really satisfying about that division. And I think in some cases people were just like, well, you know, this horse won a Breeders' Cup race, I'll vote for him. But to your larger point that you made at the top about one-offs, you know, to me, the only time you look at a one-off coming over here and giving them a significant look as if there's really nothing else in the division that stood out with their North American campaign all year. You know, in that case, you're like, well, there's really nothing else here. I guess I better vote for a horse like that. But when you've got better options, horses that competed here and won multiple Grade Ones, those to me should take precedent over, you know, a one-off campaign.
That's typically my approach. You know, I have certainly voted. I voted for Goldakova at least, maybe both, maybe twice. You know, there are certain ones that, you know, I might acquiesce. I voted Channelmaker. I voted Rushing Fall, in these two areas. And on the female sprinter side, I went Gamine, Serengeti, Bells of the One. And as you mentioned, you know, that's, to me, I've said this many times, the third vote, I very regularly will just try to, you know, give a horse that's not going to be a champion but deserves an acknowledgement, that, you know, the, you know, for instance, rather than Midnight Bisou and the older dirt female, I voted for Valiant's third, who I think got overlooked and got really good as the year went on. So I just, by my standards, I thought By My Standards was a better third pick than Maximum Security.
Okay. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, I think the Maximum Security thing comes down to, you know, how people view the Saudi Cup. But, you know, he did win two Grade Ones, and By My Standards
True.
Won zero Grade Ones. So,
True.
You know, those are, I mean, it just depends on how you know, you want to look at those types of situations. So, know, but again, in those cases, it's not going to, at least it's not going to affect who the winner is. I mean, we know Improbable, for instance, is winning older dirt, and he should.
Agreed. You know, there was one on the three-year-old front. I did see some people. It seems like some people must have forgotten about Nadal and how good he was, because I saw some people say, "How did Nadal get a finalist ahead of Charlatan?" And it's like, did you look at the records? It's you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Nadal was 4-for-4. You know, he won a division of the Arkansas Derby, and Charlatan didn't. I can certainly see how one would make a stronger case for Nadal than Charlatan based on their overall records for the year.
You know, finally, Jay, before we talk about Saturday's action, in the sprint category, I thought it was the most agonizing individual category to make a decision. And, I mean, the three obvious finalists are the finalists, Whitmore, Vekoma, and Volatil. But that's the one that I think the actual voting result is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, I agree. You know, Vekoma was very good early in the year. Volatil was very good the middle part of the year. And, you know, Whitmore won the race that mattered most. And unfortunately, the other two, you know, couldn't answer the bell for that race. And it will be interesting to see how people decided. From what I've seen of what people have posted of online picks, and that's certainly not all the voters to this point. It's just a smattering of people who decided to post their votes prior to, you know, the winners being announced. It seems that Whitmore has the most support. But, you know, you can make a legitimate case for all three.
Well, let's see. What's today? I'm losing track of time.
Monday.
Today's the Monday the 18th. And when's the announcement even? I don't even remember.
Yeah, it's still January 28th.
28th. Thank you. And I'm sure there'll be plenty more discussion between now and then. Let's turn to the action on the Derby trail. It's starting to get going, Jay, and we started the road to the Louisiana Derby Saturday with that LeCompte, and there was a lot of interest, and it started out to be a good-sized field. Some thoughts about Midnight Bourbon and what went on in NOLA.
So, yeah, Midnight Bourbon won the race front-running fashion. I thought got away with a, you know, fairly moderate pace and, you know, held off the two horses that came up to him, including the, you know, the heavily favored Mandaloon. I'm not sure, you know, my analysis of that race will be online a little bit later today. I'm still not sure what to make of that field because, you know, I had thought Midnight Bourbon last year I thought was just, you know, a nice horse, but a significant cut below the division leaders, as we saw from his performance in something like the Champagne. And, you know, Mandaloon, for all his hype, his figs were very average coming into that race. And you were taking a lot of it on, I think, a leap of faith. And there's nothing wrong with that because horses develop and get better. But he hadn't shown yet what he was that he was deserving quite yet of that kind of attention, and certainly not that mutual support. I mean, he looks like a nice horse, you know, perhaps the favorite, but, you know, on figs, he certainly was far from an odds-on standout against that group. But he ran a good race. It was certainly a career best from a fig performance for him. You know, but in the case of Midnight Bourbon, he is by Tisnow, who didn't even race at two. And got, you know, much better as his three-year-old campaign went on, to the point where, you know, after starting off as a unstarted maiden earlier in the year, by the end of the year he had won the first of his two Breeders' Cup Classics. And so with Midnight Bourbon being by Tisnow, I think you could make a legitimate argument that he's got some blue sky to him, and that whatever he accomplished at two was just gravy, and he's going to be better at this point. And, you know, based on his initial start at three, that seems like a theory that could play out, because he certainly ran his best fig in winning that race. He shouldn't have any problem with the additional distances that he's going to be asked to go in the coming months. So I'll be interested in seeing how this field does going forward when maybe there's some better horses that show up in races like the Risen Star or the Louisiana Derby, and if these horses get faster and if they make, you know, more progress compared to their brethren in California or Arkansas or Florida over the next few months.
I thought it's funny watching it live. You kind of wondered about, you know, how strong their performance was, but then watching it a couple times afterward, he absolutely holds those coming horses safe, and he, you know, Talamo, you know, keeps. You know, keeps maintaining the distance late, even though, you know, the Proxy and Mandaloon were, you know, were closing. Santa Cruz was well back as well, I don't know, the whole day. I think you know, the figures came back moderate for all the routes. I think we won't know as much as we need to, Jay, until Risen Star Rachel Alexandra weekend.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. You know, there's going to be hopefully better horses or some different horses showing up for those races to, and you can sort of compare and contrast that way. And you know, all the horses that ran the other day, and at least in the LeCompte, you know, they took pretty significant steps forward on Figs, and so you want to see if that's going to continue or if it was just an aberration. And until they run back, you don't know for sure. But, you know, there's certainly the case that can be made that with just maturity going from two to three that they have a right to, you know, to be faster at this point. Like I said, in the specific case of Midnight Bourbon, I think is, you know, being by Tiz now, that gives you, you know, if you want to look at the glass half full as opposed to the glass half empty perspective on him, that he certainly has a chance to continue to develop, you know, much like his sire certainly did.
Yeah, and you know, the whole card, of course, had various opportunities. The allowance, the allowance and maiden races, and those winners were pretty moderate as well. I think high 70s and an 80 buyer in the allowance and in the maiden race. I'm sure some of those horse, you know, particularly the allowance horse and the maiden winner, will, you know, move on and point toward the Risen Star going forward. Otherwise, Jay, trying to glance at other, I guess there really wasn't, I was just looking to see if there was other, you know, maiden routes and anything that fits the pre-Derby watch conversation. And I don't, yeah, I guess not really. Right, Right and Just, the Awesome Again colt for Shane Wilson. And the other route was the Asmussen Rutherford homebred, the American Pharoah Big Lake that necked Scarlet Fusion. That was a horse we talked about quite a bit with Mark Cassie last week. In fact, Cassie ran second and third in that maiden race. Fun day of racing, though, at Fairgrounds. Really enjoyed. Some other weekend observations. You were at Santa Anita yesterday.
Yes, for a very exciting running of the Astra, with John Sadler being running 1-2 in the race with Quick and Hermaphrodite. So that was a fun race to watch, and you know, looking forward on the 3-year old front. You were just ruminating about that. I mean, the next big weekend will be in 12 days when you've got the Robert Lewis and the Holy Bull are both on January 30. So that'll be a significant day on the road to the Derby in California and Florida, respectively. And, you know, I wrote a note yesterday that horses like Hot Rod Charlie and Rumbauer are among the horses that are under consideration at the moment for the Robert Lewis. you know, Spielberg is under consideration for that, but there's a chance he could go to the Saudi Derby. Baffert was telling me yesterday morning when I was out there and visiting with him and Michael McCarthy and Mandela to get an update on Astute, who's supposed to breeze any day now, and you know, I really was high on her before her head-scratching performance in the Starlet at Los Alamitos, but she came out of that with, you know, really sore feet and got some time off, and hopefully she'll get back on the beam, because I think she's one of the better three-year-old fillies in the country when she's right. So those are some of the updates on the Derby and Oaks front from out here.
Well, and I guess the one other sidebar to the weekend, we of course talked to Hammer on Friday as they took the first entries for opening day at Oaklawn on Friday, and you know, for many years, of course, the Smarty Jones would kick things off, and it would a lot of times would be by now, and even this Monday, but we'll look forward to Friday and a 5/11 eighth race post. For the Smarty Jones, just looking at that group.
A fine way to kick off opening day in Hot Springs.
No doubt. Cowan back out of the springboard mile in here. And field of seven came together. Safi Joseph sending in Moonlight Strike. The Liam's Map Colt off an allowance win at Gulfstream. They'll go around two turns for the first time. How about Caddo River? Brad Cox.
Yeah, it's an okay race.
Yeah.
Let's be honest. It's just an okay race.
It's okay.
The waters get very, very, very deep as you move on. I mean, you know. They just dip their toe in the Smarty Jones. When you start getting to the Rebel in the Arkansas Derby, then it gets very good.
Who was it on Friday that, or late in the week, that quizzed me on the purse of, I forget which race it was, the Razorback, I think, and I think the number was 600,000, and I think the Southwest is 750.
Yeah, they got plenty of money down there.
We kick things off. I didn't dig into the they drew the first 2 days. They drew Friday and Saturday's cards for Oaklawn. So just getting going. Well, Jay, really appreciate the comprehensive visit between Bruce Edley and Nat West Appreciations. The Eclipse finalists, and when does Derby Watch officially get going?
You mean our Derby Watch Top 20 with me and Marty McGee will start up in mid-February, like always. So,
okay.
a few more weeks away.
Nice. Well, Jay, I appreciate
it. We don't want people to OD on it. It's like, you know, we try to strike a balance between, you know, wanting to do a Derby, a proper Derby Watch countdown, and not have people just be so glassy-eyed because we've been doing it for like way too long, and it's overkill. I mean, God bless these people who start doing it in early January, but I don't know, it's a little much for, you know, I think to hold your attention for that long. And last year was crazy because of the postponement.
That's right. You know? It was
the Derby Watch that never ended. So we'll start in mid-February like we always do.
Yeah, that was a 6 month plus ordeal.
Yeah,
I love it, Jay. Enjoy the week, and don't know if we've got anything for Friday, but if we do, I'll talk to you then.
Very good. Thanks, Steve.
Jay Pribman, everybody, DRF Pribman with Pillar to Post. Lots to cover with Jay. An hour in, and Rich Migliori is going to join us next. I promised you Nick Tamaro later. I want to get into some of the results, including those Laurel Stakes. And there was a lot going on in that Winter Carnival six-pack. But one of the nicest stories, Natalia Lynch, who had been an assistant to Jeremiah Engelhart, Natalia Lynch got her first win of any kind, not just first stake win, in the Fireplug. I think it was her 12th or 13th starter. And Wendell Fong for Al Gold, Gold Square, one of our favorite owners. Big effort, too. 99 buyer with Sheldon Russell. Sheldon actually took three of the six stakes, one with wife Brittany. That was Hello Beautiful in the What a Summer. We talked about What a Summer so much on Thursday. And in the Geisha, Gale for Jonathan Thomas. So three of the six to Sheldon. Well, and since I did this, Tattooed for Tim Keefe and Angel Cruz. That was in the Jennings. And in the Extra Heat, Jerry Robb sent out Street Loot with the X-Man, with Xavier Perez. And Jesus Ruiz and Dale Capuano with Kenny Had a Notion in the spectacular bid. So there's your six-pack at Laurel. We'll get to Natalia Lynch, guaranteed. Got to have that. Nothing more fun than that. First winner and first stake winner. So we'll start to weave in some results as the morning goes on. Rich Migliori joins us next to talk about what went on in New York and more after this. Hour two at the races, Sirius XM.
It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.